Hello, my name is Troels Henriksen, and I'm here to talk about designing a programming language for the desert. I am a researcher at the University of Copenhagen, where together with my colleagues, I work on a programming language called Futhark and its compiler. So Futhark is a language in the ML family, like OCaml or Haskell, and you program it much like you program the language using bulk combinators on arrays. And then we have a compiler that can turn the resulting programs into very highly optimized code running on GPUs or multi-core CPUs. And that compiler is what our research is really about. That's what we publish papers about. But it's not really what I'm here to talk about today. Because the Futhark language is not meant for full applications. It's only meant for the small performance critical parts. It's a pure language, so you cannot interact with the outside world or a user in any way. You can only write functions that are then called by a program written in some other language. And that creates some interesting constraints on the language design, and I'm going to talk about some of those principles and some of the constraints today, although my focus will not really be the language itself, but more the tooling around it. So building a programming language of any kind takes a lot of hubris, because the average number of users for all overall programming languages is about zero, and language designers, they know this. They know that when you create a new language, odds are that language is not going to succeed. Odds are no one is going to use it. But clearly their ambitions go beyond that. I mean, no one wants to create a language that no one uses. So most languages are designed with the hope and the plan of succeeding eventually. Because they tend to have very large domains of being or being completely general purpose, you could use them for anything. And they are built with the idea that they must scale to large teams and large programs, which means you might have or need complicated build tools and debuggers and package managers and maybe one of those sufficiently smart compilers, so you add complicated language features that you have no idea how to compile efficiently, but maybe someday in the future when the language is a huge success, enough people will be working on the compiler to make it run fast. And also you assume that most of the users of the language will have it as their main language, so they will have the time and the motivation to learn all of the subtle details about how the language works and how to use it well. So in a sense, these are languages that are meant and designed for a resource-rich environment. And I don't mean machine resources. Maybe this can still be a language that is meant to run on a very small computer. By resource-rich environment, I mean that the plan is for the language to eventually have a large number of users who can put in a lot of time and a large number of maintainers who can also put in a lot of time. So you can create advanced tools and expect your users to spend time to learn about the language. And companies think like this when they push a new language, they assume it'll be a big success, but hobbyists also do so. And there's nothing wrong with that. So this table shows a handful of languages that are kind of general purpose, and that eventually these languages would all want to take over the world, or at least a domain, and be used for everything. And they're complicated, and while they might not be there yet, they are designed with the idea that eventually they can have complicated tools, they can have advanced compilers and many users and rich ecosystems. And some of them have now become popular enough that such sufficient tooling may actually exist. Some because there was a big company that just put in enough resources to make it happen no matter what, like with Swift. Others, like Rust, just became popular organically and are starting to grow pretty advanced tools because they are so popular. And there's lots of people who want to write tools for them. So these languages really want to grow up to be this. They want to be tigers, not because they want to eat other languages. Well, maybe they do, but that's not my point. But they are supposed to thrive in a resource-rich environment like the jungle, where you can have a big muscular body. You can afford to spend lots of resources because there are lots of resources available. You can always get some more. And sure, many of the languages will not grow up to be tigers. They will die. They will have no uses at all. But that's not the goal. So what about Futhark? What about our little data parallel language meant for high-performance computing? Well, that's a small domain. And because Futhark is not general purpose, you can't write full applications in it. Most programmers who use Futhark mostly use some other language and then just want to speed up some part of the program by rewriting that in Futhark and integrating it into a larger program. That also means that Futhark will always be a guest in a larger code base that is mostly not written in Futhark. This is not a resource-rich environment, because even if Futhark wins, and sure, I have just as much hubris as every other language designer, so of course I hope and expect that Futhark will win and take over the world or take over its domain, that's still a really tiny domain, and that we will still, even when we win, we still won't have that many users, our users won't have that much patience or time to spend on the language, and we won't have that many development resources. And that creates some interesting constraints for how we've designed the language. So this is Futhark. Futhark doesn't live in a resource-rich environment. It lives in a desert. It's not a tiger, it's a hedgehog. It must conserve its resources and spend energy only when absolutely necessary. It must really make sure to maximize the rewards for its investments. And the approach we've taken is a kind of conceptual minimalism. So when we design the language and its tooling and its ecosystem, we try to minimize the number of things that require ongoing maintenance, such as servers that host packages or documentation or whatnot. We try to minimize the amount of implicit behavior in the language itself and its tools, because our users will probably not memorize or study the tools or the language enough to recognize implicit behavior, so everything should be as explicit as possible. We try to minimize the degrees of freedom to limit the amount of choices that our users will have to take. And we try to minimize novelty except where absolutely necessary. So of course, we don't want to just create a language that is a clone of JavaScript. So there will be some novelty, but we try to make sure that we only do something unusual where it's really crucial to our value proposition, which is high performance execution. And really the core is we have to do just a few things so we can do them well. And we end up saying no to things that are good ideas in most languages. So what I'm arguing here is not yet that when you're designing a language for the desert, you should just do a really good job. It also means that you need to make some harsh trade-offs, say no to things that in a more resource-rich environment, those are good things, but you just can't afford them when you're a desert language. So let's look at some concrete examples of what that actually looks like. So first, let's talk about build systems and multi-file programs. So Futhark is meant for small programs, but we still want to be able to support splitting a program into multiple files, if nothing else, and to support third-party libraries, as we'll see also. Now, I don't think any programmer enjoys learning about build systems or how imports in a programming language resolves to files. And to make sure that we don't ask people to learn too much new stuff about in Futhark, our principle here is that the easiest thing to learn is something that you already know. So in Futhark, we create a very strong relationship between these import statements and the file system. So when in Futhark you do an import of foo/bar, then that imports exactly the file foo/bar.foot relative to the importing file. And that means that the semantics of importing are just exactly file system imports, with no hidden details and no other rules. And all uses of code and other files, except for a very few built-in things, must be through an explicit import. So there's no implicitly available environment or anything. Everything has to be explicitly imported. That's boilerplate, but it means that there are fewer rules to memorize. It's obvious just by looking at a file, what other files it's using. One downside of this very simple design is that files have no canonical name. For example, let's consider this directory tree where we have a main.foot, and then we have two folders that contain other Futhark files. So if we want to import the bar.foot file in the foo directory, then if we want to import that file from main.foot, we would say import foo/bar. If we want to import it from bash.foot, we would just say import bar, because it's in the same directory.